Welcome to the Hamilton Spectator Newsroom Insider Podcast. I'm your host today, Natalie Patton, and I'm a reporter here at the Spectator. This is the eighth segment in an ongoing series where we talk to reporters, photographers, and editors about what they do and how they do it. So today I'm here with my colleagues Steve Buist and Tevye Morrow, who have the first in a three-part series about fire coming out in Saturday's paper. So I guess to start, tell me a bit about what this project is all about.
What it's all about is looking at where fires happen in Hamilton over the past, over a five-year period, and the severity of those fires in terms of injuries and deaths. And I think the idea came from maybe a few places. I remember being a little bit frustrated at not seeing the outcome of fire marshal reports. We quite often, the Spectator, we report that, you know, a fire happened somewhere, and then, you know, the fire department responded, and then the fire marshal has been called in to look at the cause of the fire and investigate. And quite often we never actually see the outcome of that investigation. And that just got me thinking, but well, maybe I can look at some of the fire marshal reports for the last little while. But then I think the idea expanded into something bigger. And Steve was brought in, he got involved, and he has a background in looking at data and analyzing these kinds of things. So maybe Steve, you want to explain where it went from there?
So, you know, I think Tevye had a great idea. I think, you know, he was responsible for covering some of the, you know, tragic fires that took place last year. And I think he had this idea that maybe there was something more to the story, you know, that if we could somehow get the statistics, it might paint a picture that we hadn't been seeing before. And so, you know, Tevye, you know, doggedly got the fire department to provide us with 5 years worth of very detailed statistics. So, I mean, they included not only, you know, essentially every fire that took place in Hamilton, but it was broken down by the type of structure, the cause of the fire, if it was known, you know, the date and time of the fire. And from our standpoint, one of the most important things was that it provided us with the a little bit of the address, not the exact street address, but enough that we could sort of look at this by ward, on a ward by ward basis. And so, you know, when Tevye was successful in getting the statistics, we sort of sat down, looked at them, and it immediately became apparent what was going on here. And that's that, I guess the key takeaway message from this is that the fire statistics, so who, you know, where fires are occurring, who's being injured in them, and more importantly, who's dying in fires, really mirrors some of the work that we've done at the Spectator on, in our Code Red projects. So that, you know, there certainly seems to be a socioeconomic component to this. And what we discovered quite strikingly was that, you know, the lower, poorer inner city wards of wards 2, 3, and 4 are hugely disproportionately represented when it comes to fires, injuries, and deaths.
Now, what sort of plays into that? I mean, I guess what factors really account for the fact that these poor neighborhoods are seeing more fires and more fires where people are dying, in fact?
I think there's a few factors. The fact that there is a higher proportion of rental accommodation in those wards is a factor, in the sense that if you're living in a situation where there are maybe there's sort of a transient nature of the residency, and there are other people there that live in your apartment or rooming house, you have less control over their behavior, whether, for example, they're properly putting out their cigarette, or if they're leaving a pot on the stove and forgetting about it, that kind of thing. The other factor is if you live in your home, maybe you might pay more attention to whether your smoke detectors are working. Those are a couple of factors, and I think Steve could probably talk about the relationship perhaps between smoking and certain neighborhoods.
Sure.
So how that works with fires.
I mean, just in general, smoking and income have a very strong relationship. It's inversely proportional. So the higher the income, the lower the rates of smoking, and conversely, the lower the income, the higher the rates of smoking. So of course, we've got the lower inner city wards that have higher rates of poverty, lower incomes in general, and so you just generally have more people smoking to begin with. So that's certainly a factor, and I think another very important factor is that the age of the dwelling. So in wards 3 and 4, something like almost 80% of the dwellings in wards 3 and 4 were built prior to 1961. So that means that nearly 80% of the homes in those areas are already approaching at least 60 years old. And in some cases, you know, those homes were built in the 1940s, the 1930s, perhaps even the 1920s. And so you've just got older homes that aren't built to the same sorts of fire prevention standards that we have now in place. And of course, in the suburbs, you have homes that are much more recent in construction. And so they're a little better able to withstand damage from fires. That doesn't, of course, put aside the main fact, which is there's just way fewer fires happening in the suburbs to begin with, which is another sort of interesting phenomenon.
Do you have any insight into why that is?
So you don't want to be in a position where you're sort of blaming the victims in this. You don't want to make it seem like if somebody's living in Ward 3 or 4, that automatically they're going to be the victim of a fire, and that if you're a rich person living in the suburb, you're not. Certainly education plays a role in this, but I think it's all of the things that we talked about. It's, being in rental accommodations where you might not have any control. Did the landlord do all of the things that they were supposed to do with respect to fire prevention? Did your other tenants do everything that they could with respect to fire prevention? I think Tevye was right. If you own your own home, I don't want to say always, but you might have a more vested interest in protecting your property, so to speak.
And I was just going to say, I think it's interesting. You'll see this in the second day of the stories. We had a round table kind of chat with some firefighters who worked in the east, one of the East End stations, and they said, we always felt this was the case, that there were more fires down here in the lower city, and that that's just kind of a known quantity among firefighters in Hamilton. If you want sort of a real fast pace to your job, you work downtown. But if you're not really into that, if you want to serve a slower shifts, then maybe you work up in the suburbs or up on the mountain or something like that. Yeah.
Now, you were mentioning that you've got these statistics, you got this data from the fire department. So how open was the fire department in sharing this information with you? How easy was this for you guys to get?
I'd say they were open and sharing statistics. I think it just took they're busy people, and you have to get the right person to provide the information. But certainly they provided the information they did provide was very, very helpful and absolutely detailed, which was great. And then we sat down with, as I just said, we sat down with a bunch of firefighters, and they shared their experiences, their thoughts on the trends in the fires they've seen over the years. and also with some of the executive as well. Their overall thoughts of how they see these trends that we have found.
And so they weren't surprised by these findings necessarily.
No. I think, you know, they know where they're busy. And I mean, it's also important to point out that firefighters do lots of things besides just putting out fires too. I mean, they go to carbon monoxide detector, you know, when those go off, they'd go to medical calls and those types of things. So, you know, a fire is just a part of a firefighter's life. I think that their only concern was that they didn't want, again, like us, to be seen as somehow blaming the victims in this. You know, but yes, they certainly were well aware, I think, of where they're busiest.
They made it very clear that they treat any fire the same, irrespective of whether it's in a wealthy neighborhood or in a poor part of the city. They're professional in that regard, that a fire is a fire, and it doesn't matter what walk of life you might belong to if you're the victim. Yeah. And I should say that, you know, we don't think the firefighters who work in the burbs are lazy. Just for the record.
FYI, people.
but also, I think that, you know, they began to appreciate what we've said at the Spectator all along, much as we did with some of the Code Red projects, where we've looked at some of the health determinants, where, you know, facts are facts, and you have to deal with them, and they may be unpleasant. It's not fun to be doing this and sort of looking as if you're somehow stigmatizing areas, but the fact of the matter is, you have to, you know, you have to deal with it in a rational, fact-based way. And I think when they understood that that's what we were trying to do, you know, I'm hoping that we can all see the same thing, that at the end of the day, this will help make things better. And that's really what the goal of this is, you know. And a lot of times, the first step towards making things better is for the general public to understand what the issue is, and so that they can figure out how to grapple with it.
Along those lines, I mean, what sort of an impact do you see this series having? How do you think it might help make things better?
That's tough, because I think finding ways to address the problem would require a lot of a lot of thought, and really maybe something that's sort of out of our realm of expertise. I mean, I think that's sort of up to firefighters and the fire department to decide how they could best tackle a situation like this. We did talk to another fire department in Surrey, BC, which seems to be a leader in analyzing data and trying to find ways that data could lead to better fire prevention. And that fire department, the Surrey Fire Department, has been leading a project, at least the chief there has been leading a national project to look at risk factors for fires. And that started in BC, but it's now being applied, it looks like it's being applied across the country. Where that goes, what sort of recommendations come out of that, I don't know.
I think the other thing that came through is that sometimes it's quite simple solutions that, you know, that are repeated ad nauseum, but really are ultimately, you know, the key solution. So things, I mean, one of the things that was harped on continuously to us is something as simple as functioning smoke detectors. It sounds small, but those little things can be very, very important. And so things like, if you are a tenant, make sure your smoke detector is working. Make sure that everyone in your building is vigilant about smoke detector. You know, the firefighters that we spoke to expressed frustration where, you know, they can come in and install a smoke detector, and the city has programs that will do this, and in some cases even do them free for low income and seniors. populations. And they say it's so frustrating because they can install that smoke detector, and that night if somebody wants to have a smoke in their bedroom, they'll just pull the battery out, and all of that good work and good effort is down the drain, you know. And so the other thing is, you know, people might be afraid to, you know, if their building isn't safe, they may be afraid to say anything about it because they're afraid that they're going to get ratted out or kicked out of their apartment. And, you know, so they're trying, the fire department is trying to get the message across, never be afraid to talk to us. That's our job, and it's the law. You know, and landlords can be frustrated too, because they can go to all of the same steps of putting in the proper safety devices and then have the tenants disable them. So, you know, I think it's a case where everyone's got to work together. We have a lot of precarious housing in Hamilton, you know, so getting rid of, you know, sort of illegal conversions or people living in unsafe conditions just because they have no other alternatives. We're seeing gentrification in the city. That's probably going to play a role in reducing, because now you're going to have more owner-occupied dwellings. It's going to cause other problems because it might displace people. So, you know, there's a real variety of potential solutions here.
I guess to sort of sum up, I mean, maybe we can go back to where this started, which, you know, you're mentioning that, Tevye, that you were involved with covering a couple fatal fires last summer, I believe, where a few people died in a couple different fires. It was not obviously a good summer and early fall here in Hamilton. I mean, what was that like for you? What did you see there, and how did that impact your, I guess, your motivation to look deeper into this?
Well, I should say that some other reporters were definitely led those stories. There were two fires. There was the Niagara Street fire and the Grenfell fire, both of which we've taken another look at for this series, the aftermath of those fires. So one of the survivors of the Grenfell fire spoke to me about her situation since that fire. Her mom died in that fire. A friend of hers who also lived in that home died in the fire, and another tenant who is an older man also died in that fire. So she's been living with a friend in another apartment. She's out of work. She was out of work at the time of the fire and sometime before then. She's in a real tough spot, I think. Not having a lot of money and doesn't appear to have a lot of options insofar as where she can live. And I think it just, the situation of that home, I think sort of is a good but terrible example of the factors that we're talking about. There are a few people living in this small house, and it didn't appear that the housemates had much control over each other's behavior, or for example, if they left a pot on the stove, or I don't know, if someone was smoking, for example, in the home and didn't properly discard the cigarette. It appears also that there were no working smoke alarms in that house, according to the preliminary results from a fire marshal's update or report. We haven't seen the final report for that. So I think a number of factors sort of coalesce in this one tragic situation and really provide some of the humanity and pathos to the data and the analysis that we've seen. So we did focus on that fire for that reason, and the Niagara Street fire was another terrible fire where some young people died. And I can't remember the details of that right now.
It was a mom and a couple kids.
Mom and two kids, yeah.
Right.
I think for me, what, you know, for me, the takeaway message would be, you know, I've been the person who sort of has driven our Code Red projects for 7 years now. And I guess for me, what this one does is, you know, we looked at health and we've looked at the health of moms and babies. We've looked at cancer. And each time the message seems to be the same, that if you are somebody who's, you know, poor, or if you are living in poverty, your outcomes are going to be much, much worse than those people who are, you know, well off and living in the rich suburbs of our community. And I guess what this does is it just shows you, it's just another factor that shows how devastating poverty can be in a community. You know, something that's, you know, here's just another thing that you can add to the mix that shows and should show people, not just in Hamilton, but everywhere else, that it's just another reason that we should be taking a really hard look at figuring out how to eradicate poverty, you know. And it's a complex question, I understand that. But it's just, you know, this is just another layer of the onion that gets peeled away in this terribly complex problem.
Well, thanks to both of you for taking the time to speak with me. And people can read the stories in Saturday, Monday, and Tuesday's papers?
Correct.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Thanks, Natalie.